The answer to that question is no. God withholds, God removes things from our lives sometimes because there is a great danger of making them idols. Now, something we also talked about last week that bears repeating tonight before we finish that story is simply this. The biggest idols, right? The biggest problems that we deal with in life that we're tempted to worship, even unknowingly, but the things we're tempted to worship in life are usually good things, right? You remember that? Usually, most of the time, like if we wrote out a list of the things that, if we were really honest, the things that we're most tempted to idolize, that list I think would just be dominated by good things that went too far. They just simply went too far. And that is the possibility. That's the warning. That's what God is working on in the heart of Abraham in this story with Isaac. If you remember, I'll give you the quick Reader's Digest version before we kind of finish this. Abraham and Sarah, no children, right? So they're getting up there pretty old, getting near that century mark. Abraham's there. And God says, hey, I'm going to give you a child. And first he says, I'm going to multiply your descendants, and bless all people through them. And you start processing that. You're like, how's that going to happen? He said, no, I'm going to give you a son. But it took like 25 years for that to really pan out. Do we really trust God? Are we waiting on him? Well, clearly he didn't, because you have the whole, Jeannie, what did we say? It was the Hagar and Ishmael incident. I don't know if that was the word, but that's the problem, right? You have this incident in Scripture where we get impatient and we think, well, God said this. He didn't say how he was going to do it, but clearly this is what he wants for me, so I'll just make it happen, right? This is how idolatry begins sometimes. I'll just make it happen for me because I think God would want this for me. And besides that, my wife said it was okay, right? Sarah said it was okay, so we're just going to go with it. And it turned out to be disastrous for him. Well, as the story goes on, Isaac gets a little bit older, and Abraham is told to take your son, your only son, whom you love. Like, why are you saying all that, God? Because he's making a point. We'll finish that tonight. Your son, your only son, whom you love, and take him up to Mount Moriah and offer him as a sacrifice. And the reality is, we looked at this in the law last week, but the reality is that all the firstborn belong to God. Whether that's an animal, right? So if it's a clean animal, you sacrifice it. If it's an unclean animal, or if it's a human, you do what? Anybody remember? What's that R word? Redeem it, right? You redeem it. If it's an unclean animal and you can't redeem it, don't want to redeem it, you break its neck. You kill it. If it's a child, you don't break its neck. You redeem it, right? You give an offering. Remember when Jesus' earthly parents took him to the temple, they're offering a gift. You redeem it. Firstborns, that's what you do. So when God says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, and go offer him as a sacrifice, God is calling in what is due, the firstborn, right? Now, let's take a closer look here at the story of Abraham. We'll do that. But Abraham knows two things, and I ended with this last week. Abraham knows two things about God, right? First thing is he knows God is holy. Right? He took God very seriously. That's why he took the bundle of wood and he took his son and he made the journey to Mount Moriah. He knows God is holy. But here's what he also knows, right? And the whole Hagar and Ishmael incident proved it. But here's what he also knows. He knows God is gracious. So, now, here's what Abraham has to figure out in his mind and in his heart. How are these two things going to work together in this instant? Or in this situation? Where God is holy and God is gracious, but is he going to be able to be both here in this story? How is he going to be both. Abraham doesn't know yet. So how does this story play out exactly? Who knows how this story plays out? Somebody tell me. This is not a trick question. I just want to see if you know the story of Abraham. How does it play out? They're on top of Mount Moriah, and he lays Isaac on the altar, so he gets redeemed in the end. Huh? Good summary. Thank you, JT. Well, here, I'll give you a few verses if you want to know where that's at. It's Genesis 22. Let me read verses 9 through 10 first. Here's what the text says. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there, laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. Now, if this happened today, you better be a pretty big boy. You're not going to get a son to just stay on top of that wood. But there's something going on here. There's something about the culture that they understand something unique about what's being said here. Then verses 11 through 13, it says, but the angel of the Lord. Now, who's the angel of the Lord? Well, is this some kind of manifestation of God, or is this some angel? Lots of debate there. But anyway, the presence of God is there. The angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So, let me ask you a question here as we think about how that story ends. Did God just say, hold up, Abraham, I was just kidding, right? I was just kidding with this whole kill your son thing. Or did something more significant happen here? Again, not a trick question, but something more significant happened? I mean, is there something like spiritual going on? We've all been redeemed by a son. Okay. And so this is really kind of a foreshadowing of that reality. Everything has to be redeemed. Yeah, that sacrifice had to be provided by God. All right. In that moment, that was the only answer, right? Isaac is still God's as a firstborn. He belonged to God, but now he's redeemed by this ram in the thicket. Now, I don't know what God said to Abraham. Maybe there's more to their conversation than we have in the text. But when Abraham stops what he's doing and he looks up and he sees that ram over there, he knows. He knows what it's there for. Not a coincidence. I don't know if Abraham believed in coincidences. I hope we really don't. I hope we believe in a sovereign God. That ram is over there. I understand how this works. There's redemption taking place. And so what Abraham was able to see was that this test was about him loving God supremely. That's what it was. It wasn't really about God learning anything about Abraham. I know the text says, God says to him, he says, now I know that you fear God. Listen, God didn't learn anything about Abraham in that situation. He didn't learn anything about him. He already knew. God knows the end from the beginning. A million years from now is just like a million years in the past for God. It really doesn't matter. He already knows, but Abraham is learning some things about Abraham's heart, right? And so this is a test about him loving God supremely. So when God said, now that I know that you fear God, what he means is, now you know your commitment to the Lord. Now you know what the possible problem was here, right? And so this was a purification moment for Abraham to reorient his loves, reprioritize his loves. Tim Keller in his book said, if God had not intervened, Abraham would have certainly come to love his son more than anything in the world if he did not already do so. That would have been idolatry, and all idolatry is destructive. Again, a good thing. He gave God, he had a son, a good thing. And yet it would have been destructive because it would have been idolatry. Good thing taken too far becomes idolatry. So what seems like a crazy and a cruel act by God, this little game that he's playing with Abraham, it turns out to be an act of mercy. Right? So let's think about this for a moment. Beyond the substitution of the ram for Isaac, why would this account in Abraham's life be mercy? Let's play this out. What's the danger? Why is this merciful instead of just the crazy act of God wanting to show his power and authority? Why is this? Sunday school answers are accepted. Maybe you disagree that it's mercy. We'll take disagreements, okay? So he learned his lesson. He was corrected, right? There's a reorientation that happens, and he doesn't lose his son in the process. That's mercy. Why else is it mercy? Think about what God prevented here. And I don't just mean Isaac's death. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So let me put this scenario on us, maybe in our context. What if God, would we see this as mercy? What if God took something in our life, family like this story, job, health, anything in our lives, and it's all a good thing, right? There's nothing evil, there's nothing wicked going on. But what if in his infinite wisdom he decides to take it away, whatever that is, right? Because there's the danger that he knows that maybe we don't know yet in our own lives, but the danger is that we're beginning the process of picking this up, whatever it is in our life, and putting it on the shelf. It's becoming an idol in our life. Now, if God cut that out of our life, would that be mercy? Why would that be mercy? It prevents us from going down the path of sin, so it keeps something else from taking God's place. There may even be salvation issues going on here, right? I mean, if we persistently grab a hold of an idol and we just become enslaved to it, right? That's what Romans talks about. We become enslaved to this idol, and we disregard God. There are salvation issues. Not that you lose your salvation, it just shows us really what's going on. And sometimes we need those things removed from our life so that we don't get caught up in an idolatry that will keep us from God. So really, the issue is, if God removed something from our lives that prevented us, or that would prevent us from living a faithful life, God-glorifying life, would that be mercy? And I think, biblically, the answer has to be absolutely all day, every day, yes. Yes. What if it's painful? The answer is yes. What if it emotionally hurts? I imagine that did. Killed my only son. The answer is yes. Yes. Because it prevents us from going down that path of destruction. So Abraham's brought to a crisis point in his life. He has to choose between his love for his son and his love for God and obedience to God. Not that you can't have both, but you just can't have them both equal. Right? One is going to be on top of the other. It's always going to be that way. So let's think about this in our own lives. We have families, we have careers, we have money and possessions. We'll talk about that in a couple chapters. We have hobbies. And all of these things have great potential to become idols in our lives. So, what if, let's just think some what ifs here. What if you had to be harsh to your kids in order to make them perfect or make them accomplished? What if you had to lie in order to not lose your job? Or in order to gain a promotion at work, would we do it? Would we do it? What if you had to cheat other people or be greedy in order to increase your own wealth or your own possessions or your own comfort? Would we do it? What if you had to put aside worship of God in order to pursue your favorite hobby regularly. Would we do it? This is how you know something has become an idol. All of these things become idols and they become destructive in our life. And listen, mercy is when God intervenes to point out our idols to us, even if he does it in a painful way. Sometimes there's no other way. There's no other way. So the reality is, hardships sometimes come into our lives in order to keep our hearts set on Christ and not on idols. So here's what Tim Keller writes. He says, people, and think about this, I've said things similar to this in the past. You may not remember, but I remember saying it, so you just have to believe me. All right. Tim Keller wrote, people who have never suffered in life have less empathy for others, little knowledge of their own shortcomings and limitations, and no endurance in the face of hardship and unrealistic expectations for life. Think about it. There are things that is part of the sanctification process of our life is learned through enduring hardships, right? So let me ask you this. What are your thoughts on this statement? Do you think suffering is a necessary thing in the Christian life? Yes, and why? Think about it in terms of our propensity to chase idols. Why might suffering be a good thing, merciful thing, okay? So when we endure that suffering, right, we endure it and we see God prove himself faithful through it, it encourages us to be worshipful. It encourages us to be more staunchly committed to him. Again, elevating God above these other things in our lives. There are things that we learn about God in the midst of suffering. I say this all the time. There are things we learn about God in the midst of suffering that you cannot learn any other way. Why did God let this happen? Why did God let Isaac, what if he goes through with that? Why did God let Abraham kill his own son? Why did this happen in my life? Why did I lose my job, right? Why did this happen in my family? And again, we learn to lean in with God. We learn that God is our comfort, that he is our strength, that he is that strong refuge. We'll be able to read the Psalms differently because we'll actually get what David is saying rather than, I don't know, my life's pretty cush right now, so I don't really understand what David says. No, we'll understand that, and we'll understand why he's so passionate about God and why God would say, David is a man after my own heart. Why? Because David never suffered? No. It's because God at times had to crush David in order to crush his idols out from underneath him. Does that make sense? Maybe sometimes we're kind of like, remember when Rachel is marrying Jacob and they take off. Jacob's like, I'm done, we're leaving. And she leaves, and remember, she steals some of her father's household gods, and she puts them, you know, underneath her. You know, I think sometimes we carry our idols underneath us, and God just says, if you're going to stay on top of them, I'll just have to crush you in order to crush those idols, right? Maybe that has to happen sometimes. Think about a couple of verses in Hebrews. Hebrews 12:7 says, for what son is there, daughters too, what son is there whom his father does not discipline, right? If he loves him. Hebrews 12:10-11, God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. Sometimes that pain and suffering is for our holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later, listen to this, later yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So that discipline and suffering is the training ground for holiness, right? And when we go through the training ground or the school of suffering, those idols are further from our desire, right? So believe it or not, before this test, Abraham didn't love Isaac rightly. You're like, well, he loved him too much. He loved him wrongly. He loved him wrongly. With Isaac as an idol, Abraham might have he would love God less. He might have over-disciplined, under-disciplined Isaac, overindulged him, became too harsh when this only son, your son, your only son whom you love, doesn't turn out to be quite the perfect child you hope he will be. We do that today, don't we? We do that sometimes today. What are some of the things that are good in our lives, but we can love wrongly and fall into the same trap as Abraham? What are some of these things? Maybe some things that you've dealt with in your life. What are some things that are good, but we love wrongly sometimes? Job, money, sports. There's two athletes right in front of you, Steve. You better say that quietly. No, but it's real, right? Sports gets picked on, I think, more than anything, but it's more than that. What? Kids? I got in trouble last time I elaborated on that one. I'll leave that alone. Kids can definitely. That book I gave out on Father's Day, I don't know if anybody read, don't raise your hands or anything like that, but if you want to know how kids and family can become an idol, that's what that book is about. So here's the take home. Idols are not safe to have or to hold. They're not safe. They're not cute. They're not just little, you know, selfish indulgences. They're deadly. They're destructive. And so it could be that in each one of our lives, it could be that we need to give up something we love, something that is by itself a good thing because of what it's doing to the best thing. And I don't mean us. I mean our worship of God. Or it could mean that we simply need to loosen our grip on whatever that is that we're chasing as that all-consuming idol in our life. So how do we do this? Well, we look to Christ. That sounds easy, right? We think on Him more than anything else. I like what Tim Keller said. He wrote in the book, he said, when the magnitude of what He did dawns on us, it makes it possible finally to rest our hearts in Him rather than anything else. When we preach the gospel to ourselves each day, it's hard to chase other things. Usually our most painful moments in life are when our idols are being threatened or taken away, right? If I can't live without it, it's become an idol. Those are the most painful moments in my life when my idols are being threatened or when they're being taken away. And so hear this, and we'll wrap up here in just a second. But hear this. Many of the things that are idols in our lives can stay in our lives once they get seriously demoted, right? Now, if we come to the point where that thing, now family, all right, don't like cut your family out or anything like that, but if we get to the point in our lives where we're like, this is a good thing by itself, but it's an idol in my life, and I can't seem to have a right relationship with it, it keeps becoming paramount, it keeps becoming that thing that I chase in life, then the godly thing to do is to cut it out. Just don't do it. Just don't do it. But I have the freedom. Scripture allows me to do that. Yes, but we give up our freedoms for godly reasons. Just cut it out. If we can't seriously demote it, maybe we need to kill it. Right? And, you know, that's what happened in the story of Abraham. He didn't end up killing it, but Isaac got demoted. And I'm sure Abraham still loved his son, his only son. But he loved his God even more, right? So let's think about some takeaways. Thinking about the Abraham story, thinking about, you know, what it means to demote or kill off idols in our lives. What are some takeaways that will make us better disciples of Jesus if we implement what we've learned? What do you think? Okay? Keep God first, right? Now, that's not going to happen by accident. We're going to have to take intentional steps, right? Is it too soon to plug the Bible reading plan again? Right? All right? What else? What other takeaway?
Yeah, that's wisdom.
Right. Yeah, that's wisdom right there. It is much easier on us to go before God in prayer and asking Him to reveal those idols in our lives and walk away from them or demote them rather than ignore them and let God have to crush them in our lives or force Him to rip them away, because that's always painful. Yeah. And we want God to do that, but there's the easy way and there's the hard way. And if they say, well, okay, you know, they're looking at their watch, you know you're in for trouble, but yeah, maybe that's what we need to do. Go ahead.
Right.
Absolutely. I say, if you really believe yourself to be a humble person, be accountable to somebody. And maybe we're really not that humble if we're not accountable to somebody. Not a spouse either. I don't mean a spouse. Right? I mean another brother and sister in Christ who is either older than us, same gender, or same age and us, been walking with the Lord the same length of time as us or maybe longer, and just say, look, show me. Tell me what you see. That's painful. Can be. Unless we do it frequently, and then it won't be as painful because, again, we don't let those roots go deep. Root, man, you pull something out by the roots, you get all kinds of other stuff with it. Yeah. Any other takeaways? Yeah. Where do you spend the majority of your time? We always say this, you know, where do you spend the majority of that extra money in our lives? Where do we spend our extra time? Where do we, you know, those things are going to reveal it, you know. Is it more toys? Is it on me? Is it on anybody else? All right. Yeah. Even the good things can get in the way of God. Even our serving and attendance and don't see that as an excuse to do something else, but all of those things are good and positive, but they can even get in the way of our true worship of God, and they just become routine. You know, just become something we do. Yeah. I'm always reminded about one of Jesus' descriptions of the Pharisees. He called them whitewashed tombs. Man, you look on the outside and clean, looks good, looks right, but what's on a tomb? I mean, it doesn't matter what you do on the outside. It's death on the inside, right? Yeah. All right. We good with that? Maybe we'll try to lighten it up next week. Goodness. But it's tough. It's something that I think all of us at some point or another are going to deal with, and maybe at varying levels. But there's always that temptation for counterfeit gods or idols to creep up into our lives and become something bigger than we ever intended them to be. You're like, man, there's so much work, you know, watching myself and having other people, you know, come alongside me and watch what I'm doing. Yeah, that's what the Christian life is like. It is, you know, working out our salvation, you know, sanctification, becoming more like Christ. It takes effort. It doesn't happen by accident, right? All right. Well, thank you for being here this evening. I enjoyed our study and our conversation. And hopefully it gives us something to think about as we go home from here. Ann Wainscott, would you pray for us as we dismiss this evening, please?